Greeting, friend. My name is Eddie Noe, and I'm still a grateful alcoholic. I'm even more grateful right now. I had a few more hours. Did you see that rainbow over the mountain today? You know, this is the other end of that rainbow. It can't get any better. You know, I feel it an honor and a privilege that I have this opportunity to introduce your speaker for tonight. However, like one other person that was doing the introducing, I never met the speaker until I got here to Hawaii. I had the opportunity to speak with him on the telephone once, but it's hard to get to know a person through one telephone call. But, you know, there's something very profound about this, because between the Japanese and American, both from the mainland and Hawaii, there is a very strong, strong bond with the people of Texas. This is something that was developed in World War II in the Vosges Mountains of France. And this is something that is going to last forever, and there's always a warm place in my heart for Texans. And, you know, Texans are people who have direction. You know, they not only talk, but they walk the way they talk. And that's what makes them a unique group of people. And after I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, I started hearing speakers from Texas. And, you know, I was just captivated. You know, I haven't heard one that disappointed me. Every time I listen to a person from Texas speak, they deliver that message, you know, just like a jackhammer. Bang, 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 and it, you know, it gets etched into your new way of living. And, you know, in California, we feel we have pretty good AA in California, but by God, you know, every time I hear a Texan, you know, I have to really think it over. I mean, I think in many cases, you know, the Texans got it over us. And there is a lot of good long-term sobriety there. And, you know, when I met Jerry here for the first time, I looked at him, and, you know, something about a person that walks the way he talks, you know, there's that quiet, clear look in their eyes, you know. They don't have to have a high profile. Here's a man, you know, he could just be talking, and, you know, you could just feel the aura of good sobriety surrounding him. You know, I really consider it a privilege and a growing experience to even be anywhere near a person like that. I think God has acted in my life once again, you know, bringing me in contact with a person like this gentleman that's going to speak. And, you know, I don't want to say any more than this. I want to give him a lot of time so he can really deliver that message. And at this time, I'd like to present to you Jerry Jones. Will you give him a big welcome? Hi, I'm Jerry Jones, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Jerry.
You're saying things a little different. Aloha.
I've been sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous since January the 1st of 1973, for which I'm very grateful. These wily Orientals. You heard what he said. He gave me a little note tonight, a little memoranda. He said, somebody from Canada gave me, it says, "Dear Jerry J., just a friendly reminder, I won't be needing your help today. Your friend, God." So he builds me up and brings me down. And it's a great experience. This is a great experience. I never thought about, when I was a kid growing up in West Texas, being happy about standing up here with a bunch of flowers around my neck in front of a whole bunch of people. We don't do this in Texas much. But I'm very grateful, and it's a lovely place, and it's lovely people, and you've got a good thing going here. You've got a good thing going here. The feeling this evening was very good. You can feel the love in groups like this. It's sweet. And good. And I congratulate you for stepping out, for doing something a little new and a little different. Alcoholics Anonymous is always new and different. We're always working with a new guy because we need the new always. And the older you get in AA and the more you've been around, the more crotchety you get, and, you know, we become bleeding deacons. And we don't function well We need to stay new and young and fresh. And this is a good thing you got going here. It's good that you've got some new ideas. Keith and Don and Karen and Sally have given you some new thoughts about what you can do with your life. You're expanding your horizons about what AA is like. And you're getting a better feel for what it is across the United States and across the world. And the more of these conferences that you attend, they are not AA in the strictest sense of the word. This is not registered with New York. But it is a activity of alcoholics and Al-Anons and sometimes Al-Ateens that are all going the same direction, who have all suffered the common problem of alcoholism. And it's a marvelous thing to get well together. I really need to hear Al-Anons talk once in a while. I really do. I am the adult spouse of an Al-Anon. Billy, would you stand up, please? That's my honor. I'm really amazed that y'all use flowers for sweatbands. They gave her that there. Lots of girls perspiring a lot tonight, I notice, and kind of sops it up, I guess. I don't. I've suffered Al-Anon brutality. They call it tough love, but we know, by God, what it is. And I need to hear Al-Anon talk once in a while. I used to tell people when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, if I hurt anybody with my drinking, I hurt myself. And it's my damn business who I hurt. Get off my case. And then I heard Billy talk one night. Oh, let me tell you. I was the most uncomfortable guy in the room, and I still get uncomfortable. Because we've hurt a lot of people. And they got just as sick as we did. And it's good for us to know that and to know that we're on common footing here and we've got a great thing. God, I'm so happy that she came to Al-Anon. And you'll hear a little later, it kind of saved my bacon. And it's been so great for us to get well together with a common blueprint, a way of life. It's marvelous. I'm glad that we came from Texas to help you people in Hawaii. There's a tradition of passing it on in Alcoholics Anonymous. Everybody knows that. It dates back. It's even bigger than Alcoholics Anonymous. We had a lot of help in Texas. We didn't have any culture at one time in Texas. No class at all, really. We have some places in Texas that have unusual names, like you have here. One of ours is a little town south Dallas called Waxahachie. Waxahachie means buffalo dung. We have romantic things there, just like you do here. And it happened one time that there was a group from the eastern part of the United States would settle first, who came to Texas to bring us culture. And what they did was they were going to bring us an opera. Now, it was a traveling company, didn't have any money much, and they had the lead roles, that came along, the singing roles, they had people traveling with them, but they'd go to these little towns like Waxahachie, and they'd go to the local gymnasium, and they'd recruit a bunch of locals to fill out the chorus and the non-speaking roles, and they'd put on a little opera. And this happened. They came to Waxahachie one time and did this. And it happened that there was a non-speaking role for the heroine of the show. And a local girl auditioned and won the role. And they practiced, and her part required that she die in the final moments of the opera. Die at the hand of her lover, the tenor, the hero of the show. And so for a couple of 3 weeks, she practiced dying. And she got real good at dying. And it came to the night of the show, and it went on, and they had her all dressed up. God, they'd got a couple of hubcaps, and put them up here and tied them together and had one of those hats with horns on it and had her really gussied up, And she did. She performed admirably. And it came to the final scene, and the tenor was going to have to kill her for his part of the role, and he pulled out his rubber knife, and he gave her a couple of good punches with that rubber knife, and she flopped over and kicked and quivered and did all them things that you do when you die. Gave a very, very realistic performance. And the tenor, in the final moments, knelt beside her, and quiet settled over the auditorium. And he said the words, "Oh, my love. Oh, my love, what have I done, my love?" And the town drunk stood up in the back of the room and said, "I'll tell you what you've done. You killed the only whore in Waxahachie." You may feel like that's what we've done to you before the outside comes. But believe that we've enjoyed coming here and sharing with you this great message that we have. What's the message of Alcoholics Anonymous? God has done for me what I could not do for myself. That's our greatest promise, and that's our message. That's what we tell the drunk. Oh, we change it around sometimes because we don't think they'd like to talk about God. And we disguise it in many ways. Sometimes we forget what it is. But that's really what it is. And I want to tell you something else. We're the only group of people. We're the only way, if you will, that works for the alcoholic or the addicted person. That's just a fact. I read in the Dallas Morning News recently, they did a column, a whole issue on addiction. Bottom line, treatment centers report that 50 to 90% of those who pass through their doors relapse within 6 months. See, that's the same thing science has always had to do. Science has never, ever been able to grasp this. It's only the people in Alcoholics Anonymous who can really talk about what happens here, what makes it work here. If you read some of the finest writers in the world have sat down and tried to write about the phenomena of Alcoholics Anonymous, and almost all of them just have to stay away from the spiritual side of this program. It's almost too much to believe. But that's what works. The spiritual change that takes place is what works for us. You can call it anything you want to, but we have a transformation at some depth that produces a different kind of life. A different kind of person. Our book says we're reborn, and that sounds a whole lot like a preacher man, doesn't it? The fact is, we really are reborn. The world becomes new and bright and clean and good, and we come to places like this, and it's just marvelous to celebrate. The other thing about Alcoholics Anonymous that I think is so marvelous is the way we transmit the message, and that's through our greatest principle, the principle of experience. What man has done, man can do. That's what happened between Bill and Bob in 1935. Bill had got it. Some great power, unseen, had reached out and given him away. And he was trying it on his friends, and by gosh, that night he didn't preach. That night he shared his experience, and the guy across from him was attracted and decided he'd go for it. It's a marvelous experience. When I was a kid, I was raised out in West Texas, and I lived 10 miles north of Bovina, Texas, which tells you that I'm a country kid. And we'd go to town once a week, and I'd see the town kids. And the town kids rode bicycles, and I never had ridden a bicycle. Never had a bicycle, but I wanted one. And so I began to nag my dad about getting me a bike, and so Dad bought me a bike. Ordered it out of the Sears and Roebuck catalog. It came. We got the directions down, the toolkit, put it together, pumped up the tires, took it out on the drive, set it up. Dad was through. He said, "It's yours." I walked out and swung up on the bicycle. Went right over the top and busted my can on the other side. It never occurred to me that there'd be any kind of problem riding a bicycle. I saw the town kids ride it. They rode. They didn't fall off. So I got up, and I must have made a little mistake, and I tried her again, and I fell over again. And so my mother came along, and she said, "Well, Jerry, let me help you." So she would trot along beside it, get me started, and give me a shove, and I'd pedal like crazy until I went right in the ground again, crashed and burned. And I was, you know, had about a half day of this, and we got a lot of stickers in the ground out in West Texas, and it's hard, and I didn't have much skin left, and I came to a great truth. You know how you come to great truths? Well, I came to a great truth. And the great truth was,
I had been sold a defective bicycle. That's obvious. The bicycle I had been sold could not be ridden. And I told my folks, I said, I ain't gonna ride that bicycle. I ain't even try to ride that damn bicycle anymore. Can't be ridden. My mother was this funky little Irishman, and she said, Jerry Jones, I haven't been on a bicycle for years and years, but I could ride that bicycle. I could ride that bicycle. I said, you could not. She said, I'll show you in the morning. So the next morning, she put on some slacks. She went out. I went out to watch her. She got the bicycle. She stood it up. She swung up on it, fell right over and busted her can. I didn't even feel real sorry for her because I had warned her about that. And she got up, dusted herself off, walked around, got picked up that bike again, and she wobbled off. You couldn't really call it riding a bicycle because she just wobbled it about as far as from here to that post. Stopped, got off, and laid it on the ground and said, it's all yours. Do you know in an hour I was riding that bicycle? And that's what we have here. We have a bunch of bike riders who show you the way. And you don't have to be 15 years sober to be a bike rider either. You can be 6 months or 9 months. Because when I got here, I figured anybody that had 10 years of sobriety didn't have my kind of drinking problem. Because you couldn't stay sober 10 years if you had my kind of drinking problem. But a guy with 6 months, maybe. Maybe. I knew absolutely nothing about the disease of alcoholism. I thought I knew a lot about life. I was well educated. I was 41 years old. I was a senior partner in the largest law firm in Dallas, Texas. I had 2 college degrees. I had more money than I had ever thought I would have. I had a better position than I'd ever thought I would achieve. And none of it was worth a nickel. None of it was worth a nickel. And I learned more in the first 5 years I was in Alcoholics Anonymous than I've ever learned in my life. It's easily the most exciting period of my life. God, it was just every day I found out something new. And it went on and on and on that way. And if you're new, give it a go. Hell, take a chance. Go for it. What do you got to lose? Get in and do the things they tell you to do. Work the steps. Go for the very finest and the very highest. You deserve it. You deserve a first-class life, and that's what Alcoholics Anonymous will give you. If you'll take the action. But you're going to have to be involved and you're going to have to take the action. You're going to have an awakening. The 12th step says, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, and we start taking that book and we start taking it, putting it in our lives and processing the information and trying out the things they tell us to look for and do and take the action that's recommended, and that's called working the steps. First thing you're asked to do is consider whether you're an alcoholic. Spend about 3 or 4 chapters talking about that, because we ain't too quick. That article I read the other day said that one reason we like these drugs and alcohol was because it disconnected the cortex of the brain from the rest of it, chemically. And that made a lot of sense to me. I wasn't real well hooked up when I was drinking. I'll tell you that. Nobody ever accused me of being too intelligent while I was drunk. And I had to come and I had to look at this thing. And it didn't make sense to me that this was a disease. What are you talking about? What do you mean a disease? Well, it's got a spiritual side, let's say. It's got a physical allergy of the body. And it's got an allergy of the body, and it's got an obsession of the mind. That's what it is. And it didn't make any sense to me until I began to get some experiences, remember some things. And one day I was listening to people talking about the disease of alcoholism, and I remembered my dog, Patches. I had a bulldog. He was mostly bulldog. He was mostly an English bulldog, big devil. Good dog. A week before this story I'm about to tell you, or 2 weeks before, he'd killed a badger. Big, ugly badger. The badger weighed 1 pound more than he did. You know how we know? Because it killed him. Took him all day long, or all morning long, to kill him. And just to give you a little hint about the personality of Patches, every day for a week after that, he'd go up and pick up that old dead carcass and just shake hell out of it, just to let it know that he was still there and still there. Just in case reincarnation worked, he was going to be there. On this morning, though, he had no problems. He's a hero. He's well-loved. He's well-fed. He's scratched that day. Everything's happened. He's laying there on the ground. Not a problem in the world. No competition in sight. got to be happy. And into our yard comes the neighbor's boar hog. Big, ugly hog. Long tusk. And Patches made a decision to go get hold of the hog. And when he makes that kind of decision, they don't make them casually. Bulldogs do not make casual decisions about getting hold of. They get hold of things and they hang on. And he went out there and he got hold of the hog. And it created a problem in our barnyard. The dog was barking and growling. The hog was squealing. My dad came running out of the barn to see what was going on. And he got out there and he was kicking hogs and dogs and cussing. And I saw my dog was in deep trouble. And I get out there just as fast as I can because I'm going to have to help out. My mother sees her little boy going in the middle of this hog and dog fight, you know, and she's out there trying to get me out of it. And there's chaos. Absolute chaos. And we all know the solution to the problem. Patches, turn loose the hog. Well, he didn't turn loose, but he came off in a little bit. And we caught him. But not before that old hog had swung around and cut his throat. And so we took some medicine we had, and we doctored him up and cooled him off. Everything's okay, all right? Let's get back to our lives. We turned him loose. He went right back and got hold of that damn hog again. Same deal, squealing, barking, kicking, cussing, crying, wringing of hands, all this stuff was going on. Everybody there knew the solution to the problem. Hog knew it. We knew it. Everybody knew the solution to the problem. How could you turn into a hog? He came off again. This time we recognized that Patches was not himself. I think the psychologist or psychiatrist would say his emotional nature was overriding his intellect. And so we decided we would have to commit him. And we tied him to the water hydrant. And I guess I was his first counselor, because I was permitted the job of sitting there with him, and we ran the hog off so he would not be tempted. And I spent time with him and helped him think about things like, you know, did you ever have fun getting hold of hogs? Does your family enjoy your getting hold of hogs? Have you ever had a good day when you were hold of a hog? And I spent a lot of time with him. And I was obviously successful. Because in not very long, he had laid down on his own. I didn't have to hold him down anymore. His tongue was hanging out. He had that little silly grin that dogs get on their face, you know. And his tail was beginning to work back there, you know. And it was obvious. He's okay. He's okay. So I went to the warden, my father. And I said, I think the dog is well. He's been there 2 hours. I'm tired of staying with him. He's happy. He seems like he's okay. Dad said, I think you're right. He looked at him and he said, turn him loose. We turned him loose. He had to go 2 miles to find the hog. Does anybody identify with that story? Who were you in the fair? I don't know. In the beginning, I knew what I was. I was one of the first members of Hogganon in West Texas. But by the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I changed roles, and I knew who I was. God, I'd been there. It looked like that old dog's only problem was turning loose the hog. Turn loose the hog. But you see, it wasn't. Any more than my problem was not drinking. Drinking wasn't really my problem. Drinking was a part of my problem. But this old dog had another and deeper problem. And it was what sent him out the first time. What sent him back? What convinced him 2 or 3 weeks later that he ought to give up hogs and try cattle trucks? He just caught one cattle truck. That's all he ever caught. Had it for a minute, but it's all over then. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, you see, everybody told me I'd be a better father, a better lawyer, a better husband, a better neighbor, if I just didn't drink the way I did. If I just moderate, or just not drink. But it was obvious that I had a problem with drinking. Looked to me like I had a problem with drinking. My wife, after many years, I drank from the time I was in college. I loved it. I liked the way it tasted. I didn't either. I'm lying again. It tastes like hell the first time I ever tasted it. But I liked what it did. I liked the effect of it. I can remember that I would get absolutely excited about the prospect of getting drunk 2 or 3 days away. Friday night, we're going to get drunk. Oh, boy. No, we're going to fill that damn car completely full of booze. We're going to buy beer and whiskey and schnapps and every damn thing you can buy. And there's no telling where we're going to be Saturday morning or what we did Friday night. And I could just get, the closer I got, it was like I was in a frenzy. I just loved it. I like to chemically alter reality. And I didn't understand for many, many years that there was something beneath that. There was a great need that I couldn't handle reality the way it was, and I like to change it. And alcohol helped me change it. It helped me where I didn't care. Did you ever care? I cared a lot. Cared about being important to you. Cared about getting your attention. Cared about being acceptable to you. Cared about being rejected by you. Being insignificant to you. Being ignored by you. I lived my life trying to relate to you. I did things that made no sense at all trying to relate to you. And I tried to present one side of me to you that would, I think, would be acceptable to you, whoever you happen to be. I gave one person, if he's the bootlegger in town, I gave him one side of me. If he was the Baptist preacher, I gave him another side. And it was really hard when you got both of them in the room at the same time to be everything everybody wanted you to be. And I felt very responsible. I didn't measure up to my own standards. I had an enormous need to be a man. To be a man. That's what I was supposed to be. They told me, you're going to grow up to be a man someday, Jerry. Little men don't cry. Little men don't act that way. So I knew I wasn't quite there yet, but I was going to be there someday. And I practiced being a man. I tried to do the things that men did. And I watched my dad. And my dad was a great, rough, tough man. Macho man. He could hit himself with a hammer working on a plow or something. Blood go everywhere. One day I asked him, I said, Dad, did that hurt? And he looked at me and he said, hell no. He'd pick up the hammer and go to flaying away things again. You know. 2 or 3 days later, I'm playing. I got the hammer out. I'm playing being a man. I'm cussing a little bit when nobody can hear me, you know. I banged the hell out of the things a little bit, and guess what? Hit my hand. Didn't hit it bad. Hurt like hell. Not only did it hurt, but I cried. Very unmanly thing to do. Not only did I cry, but I was afraid to hammer anymore for fear I would hit myself again. So I flunked being a man on 3 counts. So what did I have to do? I had to play like I was going to be a man. I had to play like I was what you wanted me to be. And that I liked the things you wanted me to be. I went out for football. 8th grade. And as skinny as I could be, the little knobby knees, and they thought I was going to fill out and become a great big guy like Keith, but it never did happen for me. And they got us out there, and we ran like hell and had all the equipment on us and stacked around. It's hard to run and that stuff, and it's sweaty and it's hot, and there's stickers all over the ground out there, like I told you, and they knocked me down a whole lot of times that day, and in about 2 hours, had a lifetime supply of football. Just got completely caught up in one afternoon. A couple of my buddies felt the same way. They got their stuff off when we went in, and they got a shower, and they told the coach when they walked out the door, said, we ain't playing football. You can have that stuff. And the coach began to talk about guys with yellow stripes down their back, and guys that had it, and guys that didn't have it. And they turned to me, and they said, Jones, how'd you like football? I've been wanting to play football all my life. I like football. And so I stayed. And I played football just as long as they'd let me play on anybody's team. And I broke bones and I did all of it. I guess I got to like it after a while. But I went to it for the wrong reason. I was driven by the acceptance of trying to gain your acceptance to do the things that led me. And I've been doing that all my life. I was trying to achieve things that were going to make me happy. More, better, and different. Did you ever try to get more, better, and different? Just get something? Get a new car? Drive it 2 days, it's the wrong car. It ain't big enough. It's not shiny enough. Someone's got down the street's got a better one. More, better, and different. And I chased that. And I chased it hard, and I chased things well. And I used alcohol to take the pressure off. To let me not care. And it got to where I was drinking closer and closer and closer. It got to the point where that's what I did every day. It got to the point where I quit going places because I got drunk and made a fool of myself and I couldn't go back there anymore because I didn't get your acceptance when I acted that way, so I just stayed at home and drank there. They were going to have to take me the way I was at home. Right? You can be yourself at home, right? It's my house, and I'll do what I damn well please in my house. And that's what my wife had to live with, my kids. And poor, denuded woman that she was, she went to a thing called Al-Anon. She had given me tests during the years. She had talked to me. We had to send her to a psychiatrist because she had an abnormal reaction to people who drank alcohol. Spent a lot of time, a lot of money on that woman trying to get her to some degree of sanity, and it just never was working. One night, she was gone when I needed her, and I asked my daughter where she was, and she said she'd gone to a family meeting. That sounded very ominous to me because we were discussing divorce a lot at that point in time, and it seemed to me if we were going to talk about our family at this time that maybe I ought to be present or have a representative there. And so when she came in, I began to cross-examine her. I just love to cross-examine my wife. She's one of the most difficult witnesses I have ever encountered. I've been a trial lawyer for 30 years now, and she can duck and jive worse than anybody I've ever seen. She will not give you the truth if she doesn't want to give it to you. And I started out that night, where have you been? Out. Out where? Out at Preston Center. What was there? Some friends. Who were they? You wouldn't know them. What did you do with them? We just shared our experience, strength, and hope. And we went on and we went on and we went on, and I kept closing doors and narrowing the fields, and finally I got it down to a word. Al-Anon. Al-Anon. What is an Al-Anon? I thought it was some kind of aluminum kitchen utensil for a little while. Maybe she was going to work. And then, my God, the horror of horrors, I found out it was a public meeting. Anybody could go. Anyone in the world who had a friend who was an alcoholic or a family member who had a problem with alcohol was welcome in Al-Anon. Oh, you don't know what warm feelings that gave me. Here I am trying to hold together a law practice in deep trouble, and I know it. And this damn woman is going to public meetings with my problem. I've got to be the alcoholic, you see. There's not another candidate for thousands of miles. And I could think of, you know, there could be jurors there. There could be judges, judges' wives, partners, partners' wives, other lawyers, witnesses, clients. There were thousands of people in Dallas, Texas that could go to one of those public meetings and were likely to go at some time. And the moment they saw her, school was out. Someone would call my partners. We already had two alcoholics who were partners. I'd participated in conversations about it, what we were going to do with them. And I'll tell you what we were going to do with them. Just the first time we got a chance, we were going to get rid of them. And they were powerful guys in this law firm. They had a lot more clients than I did, had a lot more years there, and I wasn't going to have a chance. They're going to kick me out the day they find out that I am an alcoholic. And when they kick me out, I'm the only one in our family who earns money. We owe everybody in the world money every month. We had a mortgage on the house. They were going to take the house. When you stop paying them, I'll tell you, if you don't know that, let me tell you, when you stop paying the mortgage, they take the house. When you stop paying the car payments, they take the car. They come get the clothes. They do the whole damn deal, you know, the furniture. And you're on the street, naked, in the middle of the world. Little bitty kids with you. We're not worrying, Billy, now about college educations. We're talking about basic survival. It's in your hands. You must not go to any more of those meetings. And she said, I need to go. I said, please don't go. She said, I need to go. And I said, lovingly. If you go again, I shall kill you. And they'd had her wrong. If they get them any period of time, they really, you know, brainwash them early. She said, I'm going because I need to go. And it drove me crazy. It drove me absolutely crazy. Every time I saw her, I thought about this thing she was doing. And I worried every day that someone was going to walk up to me and say, here, your wife was at an Al-Anon meeting. And I picked 1,000 fights with her about this. We fought incessantly about this subject. And I'm not always as direct as I am at other times. I sneak up on people when I want to start a fight. I kind of each, you know, come in kind of casual and ask them a few questions that'll help me win my argument later on. And then I drop the fight on them, you know, and we're off and running. Well, this one night I decided I would pick a little fight with her, and I said, Billy, you think I am an alcoholic. I'm going to start real easy, you see. And she says, I don't know whether you are or not. I said, well, that's damn funny. You've been calling me an alcoholic for years. And she said, yes, but I was wrong. It's real difficult to get one going when they're acting like this, I'll tell you. And then she went on to say something that just blew me away. She said, it doesn't matter what I think. It makes no difference what I think. It doesn't matter what your partners think, what a doctor thinks. It doesn't matter what anybody in the world thinks except what you think. You're the only one that's important in this point. And then I made a mistake that no self-respecting trial lawyer ever makes. And I got to say, I did it because I was kind of off balance and confused by what was going on. And I asked a question when I did not have any idea at all what the answer was going to be. I said, well, if I wanted to find out if I was an alcoholic, how would I do it? Oh, my friends, they have an answer. She said, try some controlled drinking. I said, what do you mean, controlled drinking? She says, they tell me if you drink two drinks a day, every day for 6 months, and you don't ever exceed that amount, and you drink two every day, but no more, no less, you're not an alcoholic. I said, am I to understand that you who have been trying to get me to quit drinking for all these years would now like for me to drink another 6 months? And she said, I would. And I realized that I was dealing with a very deranged woman. I had to get away from there. And I went and got in my green chair, and I sat down, and I began to give this thing a deep think. And I didn't make an instantaneous decision on this. I knew I was drinking a little more than was probably normal. I was drinking about a quart a day. And I'd been drinking a quart a day for a long time. And I did it mostly I did it after work. Mostly I stayed at work where I couldn't drink, where I had to give the appearance of a aggressive, angry trial lawyer, sober trial lawyer, until I could not stay any longer, until I got through with the day, and then I would go home and I would drink a half a quart of B. Peters gin before dinner and a half a fifth of Armandine brandy after dinner, because gentlemen drink brandy after dinner, right? And I shook and was sick, and I'd get up and I'd do it the next day. And it was a beautiful way of life, let me tell you. And I had been meaning to cut back one of these days, just as soon as I got things kind of leveled off, when I didn't need a drink. And I realized that I was drinking a lot. I didn't know anybody else who drank that much in a day that they talked about. But the thing I thought was that I was drinking what I wanted to drink. It was my decision to drink what I wanted to drink. And I guarded that with my life. I'm not giving that up. But she's going to keep going to those damn meetings, and I'm going to be found out. And I'm going to get kicked out. I'm going to lose the only thing that really matters to me, which is my position in that law firm. The thing I've worked all those years for. And so I decided in my own mind that I will take the test. I won't tell anybody about the test, but I'll just take the test for a couple of 3 months, and she will notice that I'm passing the test. And when she notices that I'm passing the test, she'll realize that she's making a terrible mistake. She's endangering our entire family by going to those meetings. And she'll stop, for God's sake. And perhaps be easier to manage from that point forward. And so I began to try to take the test. Now, I had to make a small change in the test. Wait. I needed 3 drinks anyway. And I had a pretty good-sized glass. And what I was going to have was 2 big martinis before dinner. And then I was going to have a big brandy after dinner. And that would be reasonable. No one could fuss at me for that. And they wouldn't have. Except, I discovered that alcoholism centers in the mind. I would take 2 drinks. I would get to feeling warm and a little loose. And then I would think, well, that's about all the martinis today. And then the thoughts would come. What are you doing? What are you doing? Who supports this household? Are you over 21? Are you a man? Are you going to let a bunch of little old ladies in tennis shoes tell you how to drink whiskey? And the answer was always, hell no. And in a towering rage, I'd go to the bar and I'd drink the bottle. Now, nobody knows I'm taking the test except me. I didn't take the test every day, although I said I was going to. Some days I'd walk up to the bar and I'd think, I've had a bad day. I'm just not going to screw with the test today. And when I had that day, I just drank the bottle without any qualms at all. Or I could forget I was going to take the damn test. I just put it out of my mind for a while. Except I would always remember, always in the morning, always when I came awake, I would remember that I had blown it again. I'd blown it again. I wasn't doing it. What the hell's wrong with you? It's illogical for a person of your willpower, of your mental strength, to decide that he's going to drink 3 drinks, just 3, and not be able to do that. What's wrong with you? What's wrong with you? I gave it a fair run. I took that test for a year and a half. Never passed her one time that I remember. Didn't get drunk. Didn't get knee walking drunk every night, I don't guess, but I did most nights. And at the end of that period of time, I knew a great truth. I was awake to one fact, and that is that when I started drinking whiskey, I wasn't going to stop. I knew that. And I spent a lot of time trying to moderate and to control and to work on it, and I was absolutely ineffective at controlling the use of alcohol. I just drank more than I wanted to, time after time after time. And if you're here and wonder if you're an alcoholic, I'll tell you, decide what's reasonable and drink it. And you, if you're an alcoholic, you'll be back. Because when we take that first drink, it owns us. It owns us. Drink. Oh, we may not get drunk every time, but we'll drink more than we intended to drink. You may be able to pass the test occasionally, but if you're an alcoholic, sooner or later it'll get you. And when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, they told me those facts, and I knew that I was powerless over alcohol. I was powerless over alcohol. That was a truth that I knew. And I started to Alcoholics Anonymous in absolute desperation. I didn't go there because it was the only place I wanted to go. Billy, on January 1st, 1973, I'd passed out the night before at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, for God's sake, trying to bring in the new year, and I don't even get to dark. Woke up at 10 o'clock that night and looked out. We're supposed to go out to dinner. It's dark outside. Billy's sitting over there in her robe reading some of them damn books that she's always reading, you know. And I said, should we be getting dressed for dinner? And she said, oh, Jerry, don't you know what time it is? It's 10 o'clock at night. I've blown it again. Who am I going to blame for this one? Whose fault was this? It's all mine. All mine. And I went to bed, had one more drink and went to bed, and I got up the next morning and I told her I was going to try to stop drinking. Sorriest looking day I think I've ever seen in my life. Just gray. Had no hope. Didn't really think I could quit. See, I was in that terrible dilemma. Didn't know where I was, but I was in this twitch. Can't stop. Can't drink. And she said, when I told her that, she said, good. Would you like for me to call someone from Alcoholics Anonymous?
I said, hell no. I got myself in this mess, and if anybody's going to get me out, it's going to be me. And she happened to have a book that looked just like this one. And a little 24-hour-a-day book she handed to me. She said, you may find those helpful. And with all the grace and dignity I could muster, I threw them against the wall pretty close to her head. And I said, lady, I don't know whether I can do this or not, but you just keep them damn day A's and the literature and the kids and the dogs and yourself the hell away from me, because this ain't going to be easy. And she said something loving to me like, you got it. And I did. I started trying to do it, and it didn't seem, you know, if you're doing something that's that bad for you, you'd think, my God, when you stop doing it, it'd be good for you, wouldn't you? You'd start feeling better, right? No, not so. I shook. I couldn't be in the right place. If I was inside, I ought to be out. If I was outside, I ought to be walking. If I was walking, I ought to be sitting down somewhere, laying down. I just constant motion, moving around. Had the yippies. I was real quick. You know, yippies. Watched people. Watched people and saw people laughing and happy. Saw people who were in charge of their lives. And I wasn't. And I had something going on inside of me that I couldn't understand. So I decided what I'm going to do, I'm going to sneak in the kitchen. When she's not there, she'll leave them damn books out somewhere. I know her well enough to know that I'll get another chance to look at those books. And when she's not looking, I'll read one of them books to see what they do. So I went in there and I didn't have much time, and I apologized for not reading Conference Board of Literature. But I grabbed that little 24-hour-a-day book. And with this keen alcoholic mind, I noticed there was a date in the upper right-hand corner of every page. And so I went to January the 2nd. And it described me perfectly. It said, your life's a shamble. You're a mess. Your problem with drinking is overwhelming. You can't do anything about it by yourself. And it goes on, a little short paragraph, but it would just track me. And then it said, this year we're going to give our drinking problems to God. I want to tell you, I have never been as disappointed in anything in my life. How are you going to give your drinking problem to somebody you can't find? I've been looking for this guy, God, all my life. I've been in synagogues and cathedrals. I've been everywhere you can go, reading books, looking, cross-examining all kinds of religious figures, trying to see if they could pass the test, if they could prove God to me with clear proof, with no questions, I'd do what they told me to do. But I wanted some damn proof. And here I am in the worst problem of my life with no idea of a solution, and they're telling me to give my drinking problem to God. And I wouldn't have done what I did next if I'd had any choice at all. But I didn't have any place else to go. So I tossed that little book out in the middle of the table, and I looked up and I said, God, if you're there, I'm going to give you this drinking problem. And if you take it, I may do some more business with you. Next day, I knew something. Did you ever know something? I didn't logically figure this out. I just knew it. I knew I'm not going to get well unless I'm not going to be able to stay stopped unless I get some help. And I need some help with skin on it. Some people that I can see and touch. And I called the only place I knew to call, which was Alcoholics Anonymous. And I told them I wasn't going to have a damn thing to do with that place my wife had been going to. I didn't want nothing to do with those folks. I wanted a nice, quiet group near a country club, if possible. I would like to have only college graduates there. I was a big-time lawyer, and I had to be very careful about my anonymity. And this woman on the other end of central office said, we ain't got none of them. And I said, oh. So I went to what they had. Picked the most discreet group, called the town and country group. I had a country club sound to it anyway. Met in homes, old timers, 15, 20 years. We had one guy had a year and a half of sobriety. I couldn't imagine a year and a half of sobriety. He was their baby. They met once a week whether they needed it or not. And it was fine for them. And I went for a month there, I guess, about four times. And then one night a guy came in. He had a little of the yippies left. He was quick, like me. He came out of a treatment center. He had literature sticking out of every pocket. God, he knew more about alcoholism than anybody I'd ever heard in my life. I just sat and soaked him up because he looked like a drunk. He had 6 months of sobriety. And the magic happened. I followed him out of the meeting, chased him down and said, "What do you think about this thing called AA? And he said, "You mean this little group we're in here?" Oh, I said, "No. That's fine for them. But me and you, we need to be in the mainstream of Alcoholics Anonymous. We need to work the steps. We need to be involved with newcomers. We need sponsors. We need to go to meetings every night. Because we're going to have to change the way we think. And to do that, we're going to have to take all the steps in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and put them in our lives. That's what we're going to have to do." And I said the magic words. I said, "Where are we going to go?" And David led me into Alcoholics Anonymous. 6 months sober. And God, it was a great trip. We got after it. I took 4 steps. I went to 5 steps. I saw a lot of people in this room come into Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been blessed to be a part of their life. I found self-centeredness. I found unmanageability. I didn't think I had them. I skipped that part of the book the first time I read it. Why should I waste my time reading something that doesn't apply to me? And then one night in a meeting, I heard people talking about something, and it reminded me of another event in my life, my fishbowl. See, I got tired of watching television while I was taking the test. And so I went to an aquarium shop one day and bought me an aquarium. It was my aquarium. I got the size I wanted. I put it between my chair and the wall. I put the kind of gravel in the bottom that I liked. I put the kind of plants I liked in there. I liked leafy, ferny, pretty plants. And I put the kind of fish in there. I liked pretty, slow-swimming fish. And I put a light on mine. I could make it daylight or I could make it dark. I fed my fish, if my fish were to be fed. Sometimes it was a land of plenty, and sometimes there was a famine upon the land. And sitting in this meeting that night, I got to remember my damn fishbowl. And they were talking about unmanageability, and they were talking about self-centeredness, and I thought about my fishbowl. And I remembered that there was always one bad fish. There was always one fish who absolutely, generally he was the ugliest one there, a bowl cleaner of some kind, you know. And he'd get after my favorite fish and go up and bite him on the tail. And my fish would try to swim away from him, and he'd swim faster, and they'd get to going, and they'd pass other fish, and other fish would get excited, and the first thing you know, the whole damn boat was just going off. And it just drove me crazy. And I'd reach over and I'd slap the side of that boat. Boy! Let them know there's a power outside that boat that is unhappy with them, by God. I was fair. I gave them 3 chances. I let them know the power was displeased 3 times by slapping the side of the bowl. You would think they'd learn, wouldn't you? Well, it turns out that some of them didn't. And it was obvious that certain fish needed a greater hands-on experience with the power than they'd been getting. So I bought me a little dip net. And I would catch the bad fish. After I'd warned him 3 times, I caught him, I put my hand on top of the little dip net, and I held him in my lap. And had a drink. Let him get real still. Now, at this point, I want to tell you, if you ever try this, timing is very important. Then I would flip them back in when it's the appropriate time. And I want to tell you now, if you do this, if they float, don't bother with them anymore because they're gone. And I gave them 3 dip net treatments. Now, you know, with 3 claps of thunder and 3 hands-on experiences, any reasonable fish would learn. And I have to tell you, there are such unfortunates, they seem to have been born that way. So the 4th time I put the dip net on them, I looked neither to the left nor to the right. I walked directly to the commode and flushed them. No one in the world knew I was playing that game. And here I sat, the big-time lawyer, cocky that I had managed my life very well. I was not self-centered or selfish. And that night it occurred to me that, you know, you couldn't even run a fishbowl. It also occurred to me that not too many big-time lawyers were worried about and having bad emotional reactions about what their fish did. That might be called self-centeredness. And so, with your help, with your loving help, I begin to find it. Find a thing called self-centeredness. The book tells us to find it. It's our responsibility. We have to be involved. We have to find it. We have to tell someone about it. We have to be entirely ready to have God remove it. We have to be willing to correct the wrongs and harms that we've done to others because of it. And to make those amends and rectify that situation. And when we've done that, when we have done that, no matter how falteringly, we will begin to experience the power. You don't have to look for it. It is there. The effect of the power will occur in your life. You don't have to believe it's going to happen. You don't have to have an ounce of faith. You just, by God, have got to take the action. Take the action and the result will follow. There is no better proof in the world than that. If I tell you there's a thing called gravity, it will attract you to the earth. If you step off of this building, it will cause you to strike the ground. And you step off, it'll happen. Do you believe gravity? Sure you do. And it works every time. But you can't see it, can you? You can see the effects of it. And I see the effects of this power in this room tonight. And the effects of this power are felt and seen in lives of families and men and women all over the United States and the world today. The power is there. We have to take the action, which is the steps, and we will experience the power. Don't talk to me about what you believe. Find out what... I mean, you know, it doesn't do any good for me to talk about what I believe. You need to know what you believe. Be willing to add to that. And your belief in this power will grow. And it's your own beliefs. It's your own experience. It gives you a strength you never had before. It's the finest thing that ever happened in my life. And it continues to grow. I never, ever will get it all experienced. Because I'm always going to have self-centeredness. And I'm always going to be imperfect. And I'm always going to have difficulties as I go through my life. And I've had lots of them. I'm just a human being who's trying to get along. But there's nothing that's happened to me in my life that has been so difficult that I couldn't handle it with this power. And to have you along with me to support me in those times when I need the help, and for me to support you in the times when you need the help, is such a marvelous experience. We're all going the same way in the same direction, and it's wonderful. 11 years ago today, the little Irish woman that I told you about died. She died of cancer. She got cancer before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I loved her so much. She was such a great gal. I always knew there's one place I could go, and I was accepted. She'd take me. She didn't like what I did. She didn't like the way I was drinking. She told me I was ruining my life and going to ruin my family's life. But I always knew there's one place I could go to. She got cancer, and they operated on her, and we thought they got it. And then several years later, it came back. And I went up there, and I was toward the end of my drinking. And I wasn't in a good place, but I had decided that time that I wouldn't drink when I went to their home. I didn't take any whiskey with me. And I went up there, and I stayed around, and I didn't drink for a day or so till they got ready for the surgery, and they had a surgery, and God, didn't seem like they were in there any time. When the doc came walking out, the old family doctor was watching the surgery, came walking out and walked up to my dad and I, and I'll never forget what he said. He said, "Boys, it ain't no good. It's everywhere." He said, "They'll close her up, but she won't last a year." And all the resolve I had, you see, all the need to please my mother, all that just went somewhere. I don't know where it went. I don't know how it went away. I surely didn't love her any the less. But I just, like a zombie, I turned around and walked out of that place and went to a bar and bought some vodka and played like I was sober for several days while I drank vodka and coffee or whatever I could get it down with. And everybody knew it. Hell, I wasn't fooling anybody. And my mother, I went to see her when she got back from the recovery room, and she could smell it. She told me later.
And she got over the surgery and chemotherapy seemed to work for her for again. And a little while later, I got into Alcoholics Anonymous. First thing I ever did in AA was just mail a copy of the book of Alcoholics Anonymous to my mom and dad. Told them, don't know whether I can do this or not, but this is what I'm going to try to do with my life. I made a commitment to that. And I worked those steps, and I had a lot of fun, and it was a great experience for me. And we thought chemotherapy would whip this thing with mom one more time. Then, when I was about 5 years sober, I got a call. Said, better come up here again. They found another lump in mom's stomach. Looks like we're going to have to do this again. So I went up there, and this time, Holly had been to a lot of AA meetings with me, and it was just a different kind of deal. And I talked to my mom for a while, and we were easy and at peace with each other. She said, Jerry, get the family in here. I need to talk to them. So I rounded everybody up and brought them in. She said, folks, I've been fighting cancer many years. I'm tired. I don't know. I said, I ain't going to quit. But I don't know whether I can do it this time or not. She said, it's going to be hard for you. It may be very difficult for you. She said, in this time, you can lean on Jerry. He will be your strength. And that's the way it was. They operated, and it was a nightmare for 2 weeks. And thank God she died. My dad had a rupture, an ulcer that blew the day of her death. They had to take out half of his stomach. It just seemed like the whole world unraveled right there on the right at the end. But do you know something? I never thought about taking a drink. Not one. Same boy, same mother, same situation. Only change between one time and the other was that the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous had given me a power. A power that would take me wherever I needed to go and let me live one day at a time, sober. Happy? Not that day. But I wasn't out of control. It'll work that way for everyone. It will work that way for everyone. I've seen it so many times. And any old timer you talk to will tell you story after story about how it happens. We do have a program that will put us in touch with a power that will change our lives. That will change us in such a way, as it says in our flyer here, to make us happy, joyous, and free. Free of the drug that dominated us. Free of ideas. Ideas. Thoughts called resentments. Thoughts called fears. Things that drove us and dominated us all our lives. It will teach us to live happily and comfortable with those kinds of things coming our way. Because we learn how to do take care of our business and to work with other people. And that's the key, you see. What the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous really accomplish, in my opinion, is they take a self-centered person like me and change me into another centered person. A God-centered person. Someone who's trying not to do my will today. I'm going to have to use my will somewhere or other. Even when I'm not, if you're not working the steps, you're using your will. If you're working the steps, you're using your will. You're using your will every day. That some people tell you don't think. You're going to think every day. I never have had a day when I didn't think. It's what you think about that's the key. And Alcoholics Anonymous tells us what to think about and how to act on the thoughts that we have. And this transformation takes place in our life. And we are made into different people. We can handle the world in the way it comes to us. The power, we make contact with the power. A few years ago, I was in one of these meetings, and a thought occurred to me, what would it be like if we came to the Kona Surf Hotel and said, look,
We got a group of people here. We've committed most of the crimes that are on the books. We've stiffed a lot of creditors. We're real bad about paying our bills. We lie a lot. We cheat every time we get a chance. We've fathered kids and left them all over the world. And we've just done all kinds of real cute things. And what we'd like to do is get together and have a little conference here in your hotel. Do you understand that's what's happened here? That's what's happened here. The power has brought us here. The power has taken us where we couldn't go. The power does things with our lives we couldn't do. I'm going to close with this story. Lois Wilson, Bill Wilson's wife, died not long ago. A marvelous woman. Al-Anon, founder. She's been to every international that I've been to. And always it's a big fanfare when Lois showed up. And there was always a luncheon where she talked a little bit, a few words, you know. And she's been old and infirm ever since I've known her. I read her book, as Lois remembers. And it's a marvelous story. She remembered a hell of a lot more than Bill did, you might be. She was dying, and she was on a respirator and couldn't speak. And the manager of the General Service Office went to her hospital room that last week. Just because he felt like someone from Alcoholics Anonymous ought to show up. And he walked in and she could hear him. And he sat with her and he talked to her for a while. And he told her what was going on at the office and what was happening in Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon. And when he had stayed, he thought long enough, he said, "Lois, I want to tell you that all of us in Alcoholics Anonymous want to thank you for our life, because you played a vital part in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous." She had a little pad of paper. She couldn't speak, but she grabbed her little pad of paper and she wrote, "Not me, God." And he said, yeah, I'm sorry, that's right. It's God. But Lois, you were his messenger. She grabbed the little paper again and wrote, "And so are you. And so are you. You represent the only hope some alcoholic has. I don't know who he or she might be. But you've been given a gift. You didn't get here because of justice. I didn't. Thank God there's some mercy in the world. We didn't deserve what we've been given, but we have those to whom much is given, much is expected. And we owe it to give it back. We need to keep the faith. And from my perspective, the way you could best keep the faith is go back to your group and take the excitement and love you found in this convention and practice it this next year. And bring a newcomer with you next year when you come back. Fill this place up. Keep the faith. Keep the faith." God bless.
I'm at loss for words. Golly, Jerry, thank you so very much for, you know, sharing your experience, strength, and hope with us in such an eloquent manner, thereby enabling us to yes. I was so overwhelmed on forgetting things, but thereby enabling us to benefit from this, and as a token of our esteem and appreciation. Let's give him another big hand. It's ticking.
It's ticking. It's got more paper. Here we are.
The snuff box.
There we go.
Thank you so much.
There will be a brief coffee break after this. Are we going to close this meeting at this point with a prayer?
Okay. I'd like to make the announcement beforehand, though. There will be a brief coffee break following this meeting, and following it, immediately following it, there will be entertainment here. So if you would come back here, you will get some good entertainment. And then I'd like to also announce that tomorrow morning at 9 a.m., there will be a God as you understand him meeting here in the same location, same time, same station. Okay, with this, after a moment of silent meditation for the alcoholic who still suffers, I'm going to ask my sponsor, Mac, to lead us in the Lord's Prayer.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen. Keep coming back. It works if you let it.